Welcome to the Azure Podcast, a weekly podcast to keep you up to date on what's new on our cloud platform, Microsoft Azure. Your hosts, Cynthia Crane, Evan Basilik, Sujit DeMello, Kendall Roden, Kel Teeter, and Russell Young discuss a different service or solution on each show, with subject matter experts to explain how to get started, how different services work, and how to make decisions in tricky scenarios. You can find out more about our podcast at azpodcast.com or follow us on Twitter at Azure Podcast.
Well, welcome back to the Azure Podcast. This is episode number 331, being recorded on the 20th of May, 2020, with special guest Allison Farris. I'm Sujit, and on Teams with me, I have Kendall, Cynthia, Kel, and of course, our special guest Allison, who we'll get to in just a minute. But before that, let's get to the latest and greatest news in the Azure space. So I know there were a bunch of updates yesterday from Build, right from day one of Build. Maybe way too many to announce here, but are there any specifically that you guys like from that list?
Yeah, I dropped a link in there. There's one. This is a it's kind of a mashup, or it's a bunch of different things specifically around development. And you should take a look at it. It's called Code Collaborate and Ship Your Apps from Anywhere. And it basically covers a couple of different big places or big areas that we'll probably need to talk through on the podcast at some point, from the Visual Studio Code spaces to, you know, basically the Kubernetes for Windows, all the way up. So it's all centered around, you know, being able to do your development wherever you are, you know, in this COVID time and all these different things, being connected, having the ability to run, you know, basically your dev environment in the cloud or run it locally if you like. Live share obviously is something that continues with Visual Studio, and they kind of demonstrated that. And then GitHub Actions. Again, these are huge buckets. You can't cover it all here right now, but they actually released a VS Code extension for that now to basically help. You know, I felt that pain myself with GitHub Actions and this YAML-based deployment stuff, because I wasn't 100% sure, like, what are all the parameters and what are the different options I have here. Discovery was always like an issue. And I think that's this, at least to me, looks like that's a kind of a sum of an answer to that.
That's great. Thank you. Who else has put stuff in here? Let's see.
I put one for the public preview of Project Bonsai. Project Bonsai is a company that Microsoft acquired probably a little bit more than a year or more ago. They're actually based out of Berkeley, and what they work on is something called machine teaching. I got to see one of their demos, and it was really interesting because if you think about balancing a broom on your hand, that's a pretty easy task for a human to figure out how to do. But in terms of like machine learning and AI, it's actually very difficult to get to that state. So what machine teaching does, it's incorporating the knowledge from experts other than just extracting it from data itself. And of course, like these AI agents can be deployed not only to the cloud, they can also be deployed to the edge or the device. So that's coming out for public previews for people that are hoping to optimize their industrial control systems. They're meant to empower customers to build, operate, and manage different autonomous systems.
Nice. Very nice. I know Evan put one in here, but I'll, since he's not here, I'll talk about it. The Azure Private Link Service. We know that it started with a handful of services that it supported, and now it's growing in the kind of services that it supported. And I'm happy to say we now support cognitive search, event hubs, service bus, backup, container registry, event grid, and also SignalR, IoT hub are in preview as well, the last two. So a lot of announcements are coming out of Build, and I think this is something that will be very interesting for our enterprise customers who really want private link for everything, right? They really want private link for everything. They don't want anything out on the internet by default. So this is something that will be a big interest to them.
Yeah, I also want to just add something. I know we just talked about the fact that there's a million updates from Build, and frankly, I'm still getting up to date on what those are. But if you haven't already heard about this resource, this is just something I want to kind of put out there for everyone. It's called azurecharts.com, and it's really, really comprehensive, and it's continued to grow. It talks a lot about different Azure services, where they're available, any updates around those services. And they even have a learning tab. And if you go into the learning tab and look under learning highlights, you can actually do a time-based filter. So it'll show new learning around different services within the past 24 hours or 7 days that we've updated. So I just think that this is a good resource for anybody that's looking to kind of dive into these new updates that are coming out of Build and just generally keeping up with some of the updates that we go over each week. So I know it's a bit more high level, but it's just because if I went through all of the exciting updates from Build, I think I would probably take up the whole time. But I will say at least, I know we talked about Azure Arc a couple of episodes ago with my teammate Joey. And so they actually have provided Azure Arc for Kubernetes in private preview, in public preview. So that's definitely something that I would recommend looking into if you found that to be an interesting concept. Once again, just a lot of customers talking about that. So I'll just share that quick update.
Cool. And that's the data services for Azure Arc. Is that right, Kendall? Or just Kubernetes running in a managed service?
Yeah. So I don't think that I don't see the data services one being in the updates that I've seen. So it's the one specifically for managing the Kubernetes clusters, regardless of where they're sitting, be it in another cloud provider or on premises as well.
So you kind of get that experience that's similar to AKS today, but in your own, you're kind of hosting it on your own kind of thing.
It's more being able to have consistent configuration. There's certain things that you provide across AKS and other cloud providers, but if anything, it's kind of a single pane of glass for putting certain policy or configuration on the clusters. So there's still a lot to be desired there and a lot that's evolving, but it's more from like the config perspective and policy perspective than it is the management aspect of what AKS does.
That's cool. Thank you.
And didn't they just announce not too long ago Windows Containers is GA'd now? For Kubernetes. So that one's a big, yes. Customers are excited about that one. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Yes. And I guess I know customers are excited about it, but sometimes I wonder like what are the various use cases for that? Right. I mean, traditional .NET applications, as far as I can see, is the only use case for a Windows container. Can you think of any other use cases for using Windows containers?
So I can speak a little to this, Alvin. I don't know if you want to. I feel like maybe this is actually a really good topic to bring someone on from the product group from the Windows side. But I've had a lot of conversations with customers recently, and I think the really compelling use case is for the lift and shift scenarios, because right now, if you're modernizing, you're going to go towards the Linux, the Linux world. But I do think it's interesting when there's a conversation around the group managed service accounts, because if you're using Kerberos or any kind of Windows auth, we're still not providing that in AKS. So even though you could do Windows containers, you're not going to be able to just port things over if they're using that like traditional Windows auth. So I think that that's still a blocker for some customers, but I think it's something that the team is focused on. So I would be curious to have the PG come on and maybe give us a little bit more insight there, because I think that that is a question that we need to kind of create a little bit more clarity around.
That's cool.
Yeah, because I have a customer who run everything fullfat.net in cloud services, like classic cloud services. And so one of the things that they are wanting to do is obviously modernize, but they don't have the business case to really pay for that rewrite. And so they're looking into, does Windows Container solve that low-code refactoring migration or lift and shift in a sense to Kubernetes? So that's a use case that they're exploring at the moment.
That's good. Yeah, those are both good use cases. Thank you. Well, I think that's a good update, right, for today. Shall we get on to our main topic here? Let's do
sure.
that. So thanks, guys. So Allison, go ahead and introduce yourself to our listeners. Let us know, what you do, what you're passionate about in the Azure space, and we'll take it from there.
Yeah, sure. Great. Thanks. So I'm Allison Ferris. I am currently based in the UK as a cloud solution architect, where I work predominantly within the retail industry and help customers either adopt cloud or just become successful in their cloud journey and migration journey to Azure, part of the customer success unit at Microsoft. And
so I see,
yeah.
I was going to say, I see you.
I'm very passionate about serverless at the moment, so missed that one out. But
yeah, of course. And I see you've switched your pronunciation of the word Azure already. See, you've taken over the UK pronunciation.
It's everywhere. It's funny because my family, I'm chatting to them, and they're like, oh, are you just trying to put on a British accent? We don't understand. I was like, what am I? Do I sound? There's no way, because I sound extremely Southern in the UK. So I have to kind of check myself, because people are like, oh, where are you from? You have a really strong accent. I'm like, yeah.
I also just want to call out really quick, too, that Allison and I went to college together, and she was one of my TAs in college. So, her and I go way back.
Kendall was a star student. I'll say that.
Whatever.
Quickly surpassed all of us. So, it's great to be able to catch up with Kendall and roll tide. So.
Yeah. All right. So I know you said you're passionate about serverless. So what are you seeing in your customers in this space? I mean, I know serverless is, we have a number of offerings in serverless and Azure. What do you see as the common driver for serverless in your retail space, for example?
Yeah. So I think for me, what really made me really excited about serverless is, being a developer and then switching into an architect role, the one thing I hated to do was worry about infrastructure and have to worry about just networking. And I wanted to be able to just quickly be able to deliver something fast. And so one of the biggest trends that I see from customers are, seeing the benefits of being able to ship products quickly and not having to worry about the underlying infrastructure that may ultimately block them from getting really building agile processes into their development teams. And so that's something that is really exciting, and specifically within like the function space is where I see customers really wanting to lean in and learn more about, because of the compelling story around automatic scaling and cost optimization opportunities when trying to, build for maximum peak sales, but then having to right size it when, there's not a massive sale going on specific to like an e-commerce application. But.
So I have a question for you, and this is more for, because I feel like I'm still struggling through how to tell this story really well. So I'd be curious just to get your specific viewpoint on it. So now that we have, invested so much in AKS, Azure Kubernetes Service, Kubernetes in general, containers, and you get some of those, you get some similar benefits, right? The concept of your pod scaling based on the workload, and even bringing in kind of the Azure Functions runtime kind of through the CADA project for scaling based on events and just things like this. Where does that sit when you have customer conversations about Azure Functions? Because I do have customers who, I've talked to that are still interested in Functions, but then they say, hey, should I do kind of multiple functions and tie those together with some kind of gateway? Or should I, should I just think about AKS and not even really consider functions anymore? And to be fair, I don't have a super compelling story for that. There are certain things that I've kind of pulled from, but just curious what your take is on that.
Yeah. And I think that's a great point. And that comes up so often with a lot of people. And I guess one of the things that helped me kind of wrap my head around when to use functions was really like use case specific. So one thing that comes to mind is, is it truly an event driven architecture or process that you're looking into? And so one of the benefits of functions is that it allows you to really build lightweight APIs and kind of isolate different types of functionalities within your system. And specifically within like an e-commerce application, for example, your shopping cart is one API, your clicking checkout is a whole different event-driven architecture API that you might be wanting to look into and adopt functions. And so that's kind of where I have to work closely to understand, what is it that you're trying to achieve. And I think where functions are great for web APIs, lightweight APIs that you're wanting to independently scale with both websites and mobile backends. Processing, so like event streaming is something that is starting to kick off, and IoT, especially now in the IoT world and within event hubs, it would be a really good use case, being like the glue between systems. So say that you have this continuous API or function that needs to run in the background, between different systems, and that would be a really good use case of like gluing two things together, automating scripts and things like that is something that comes to mind. So I don't know if that's like the cherry on top, but that's kind of where I like to start on like understanding, you know, what is it that you're trying to do and does it make sense to adopt functions or will it cause you more pain long term?
No, I actually think that's a really good point. And it brings to my mind the concept of Kubernetes has a huge operational overhead that functions do not come with, right? Like if you're really trying to do something lightweight and quick, have fun adopting AKS because the reality is you have to be very aware still of how to run it. And functions is kind of not in, on that space. So I think just even you saying that kind of brings out that thought in me like, oh, you're right. You know, it takes maybe a couple of days to get up and running and feel good about a function, whereas Kubernetes is a bit more of a process. And yes, and I guess no, I guess it's also the one-off things, right? It's like, hey, we don't want to modernize our whole system, put everything in containers, move it to Kubernetes. But it'd be really nice to take this one piece of code that kind of seems to be running a lot more frequently that we could break apart. And so I feel like functions is a really good first step. So yeah, that actually did clarify a lot for me. And now I'm thinking a lot.
Gosh, I'm still like trying to wrap my head around AKS and Kubernetes. There's just so much that you have to learn from going from like full-fledged PaaS to AKS, and you have to learn all about. In a lot of ways, it's a lot of infrastructure that you didn't realize you had to know when learning Kubernetes.
One thing I've always tried to understand is if a company or a particular organization decides to buy into serverless. Do they go all out with serverless? Like, is it serverless everything, or should it be like, okay, now this part of my architecture will be make sense in serverless. That part, maybe AKS makes sense, you know, you just say, you know what, I'm going to, I like this serverless, I bought into it, I want to do it everywhere.
So what I've seen across the customers I've interacted with are taking more bite-sized chunks. So they'll identify, and also, important to note that like specifically in a microservice architecture. So I have a customer who, you know, really has each team's kind of structured around their APIs. And so they have this microservice architecture and approach to development. And so one of the things that they do is, you know, they want to identify, you know, a core process or one portion of their, you know, one small functionality, quite literally, and kind of take it step by step. And so I think that's something that's a really compelling story, especially when customers are trying to get out of a data center because it's expensive or they have scaling constraints. That's always like a really quick win for them to really iterate and test and be able to deliver quickly for a big migration. So really cool stuff. And hopefully we get more serverless opportunities from that.
Yeah, I mean, I'm interested too, like you mentioned functions being one element of the serverless, but like there's a lot of other things that have been built on top of kind of functions like logic apps and our Flow platform, like the Power platform and things. So I'm interested if you see customers like to Sajid's point, sometimes it's like, yeah, this is kind of like a building block for me to build applications on. And then sometimes it's more like citizen developer, like I need something that can do this thing for me, but I really don't even want to build a function for it. And if customers are kind of liking that or adopting to the like Logic App, Flow App, that kind of thing.
Yeah, no, and Logic App is a really cool serverless. I feel like it's really underrated. Like I feel like more people should be talking about the capabilities of Logic Apps. but I think the customers that I deal with definitely leverage Logic Apps, but I think for them and kind of at the scale that they run at, they integrate a lot more with like Service Bus and Cosmos DB and, you know, having them kind of trigger an event through functions. And so that's something I've seen a bit more and it'd be interesting to know like how other customers, how they leverage Logic Apps and kind of extend that through functions if they do.
Allison, in your customer conversations, how often do customers need like VNet integration? Because that's something I see a lot is like a lot of customers sometimes when they're looking at functions, oh, it's super nice, consumption, great, great, great. But then they're like, oh, but we also need it running in our VNet. And so I feel like that kind of we're integrated with our VNet. And so I feel like that can sometimes be a constraint. I don't know if that's something you've experienced. Just kind of curious.
Yes. Oh, yeah. That's always like the top question of security. And we want to lock down our function. And so one of the first conversations and the most commonly asked question is, how do we host, you know, which hosting option do we adopt? You know, they have currently they have a consumption based hosting option that allows you to rapidly scale out, but then you have no VNet connectivity option. Then you have the app service plan where you can run your function in kind of like a preset environment that incorporates VNet connectivity. And you have a little bit more flexibility over the environment that you have because you kind of own that server, as is like a really basic explanation of that. But one of the things that the product group announced maybe like 5-6 months ago, not too long ago, was the premium plan, the premium consumption plan, where you still have the full-fledged like auto-scale capabilities that incorporates VNet connectivity, for example. And so that's something that really drives their decisions on which hosting option that they want to do based off of their particular requirements and scale-out requirements as well.
One of the things I found out recently, which is nice about functions, I think, is that they keep another instance ready, like warm, ready for you. So when you do have to scale out, it's not like, you know, you're waiting for something to boot up or something like that. Apparently they have, like, they've actually, it's part of the cost model is that they pay for having that other instance ready to kind of take on the traffic almost instantly, which I think is really nice part of functions.
Yeah, no, and it's very attractive, like the notion of, because originally with the consumption plan, before the premium plan was introduced, you didn't have like warm, or you didn't have a hot start. The hot and cold start is kind of what they coined it. But originally it was just like a cold start, but it would take, you know, a lot longer to kind of scale than something that was pre-warmed or quote unquote hot. And so with the introduction of the premium plan, you always have at least one instance running so that you're able to rapidly scale and have really fast auto-scale capabilities. But the trade-off, of course, is, you know, that's always running and you pay for what's running. So, it's a really good point.
Now, you know, I've used like the Event Hub trigger, I think, and the HTTP trigger for functions. Are those the two primary ones that most, I don't even know. Are there other triggers? I'm not really sure. But those are the two that I've used most often. What are you seeing with your customers?
Yeah, those are two very common triggers. And you know, Cosmos DB has great integration. Mm. Service Bus has great integration with Azure Functions. Storage Queues is one that comes to mind. Event Hubs, Event Grid, IoT Hub. I feel like they're always releasing more every couple months, but those are the ones that come to mind. Yeah.
I was going to say one other thing that you guys were talking about, kind of the life cycle and, you know, these premium plans and things. So one thing I've been a little confused about, maybe our listeners are too, around durable functions. Like when would I use something like that? Because I feel like if I'm going to have something persistent and running there, why don't I just create an app then? What do I need to have a serverless thing because it's going to be persistent?
Yeah, no, that's a good point. And so I haven't actually been able to work with durable functions, but from, I guess, my like baseline understanding of durable, it's kind of similar to like a workflow. Like if you think of logic apps, it would be kind of the code first approach to a logic app. And so if you needed any kind of orchestration and or like chaining your function or function chaining, that would be kind of a good use case for durable functions, kind of as an extension to functions more so than like a replacement of logic apps, depending on the use case. Like stateful serverless orchestration, I think is like the main term used to describe.
Yeah. Yeah. The area I've seen those, I've heard them used a lot is like lookups, right? So like if I have some service out there and like, it's going to do something for me, which could probably be serverless, but then it does some sort of lookup, like some reference table or something like that. I've seen people using it for that, which kind of makes sense a little bit, you know, so that you can have, you know, hot data there that's super easy to kind of use, you know.
Yeah, and I think the key another thing is that like with functions, you have limitations around how long a process can take. So for the consumption-based plan, there's a limit of like 10 minutes that it can be running before it just shuts down. Whereas with durable functions, it's a lot longer. And I think I read an example somewhere where it's like if you say that you need to like generate a report based off of like a couple of data sources. So like you have a Cosmos DB, you have an order processing system, and you need to take information from the order processing system and Cosmos DB, and you want to generate a report. A durable function could then be able to say, hey, I want to grab like the last 7 days order from Cosmos, and then I want to be able to query kind of the status of each order that's currently being processed, and then generate a report of some kind. And so that kind of helped me understand when I might want to consider using a durable function, because that could take, you know, longer than, that could take days, right? Like that one order could be not shipped yet, and then it would take 2 or 3 days to be able to actually come back to say, all right, now that I have this data, I want to generate this report.
Yeah, and I think the reality of that is, Allison, some people still really want to stay away from having to manage the infrastructure. So at the end of the day, it's like, you know, the same way you could use logic apps for certain things that you could also use functions for, I think it's just another option. I don't necessarily think it's like, oh, this is when you're going to use durable functions every time, but it still does abstract away. If you had an application, you're having to manage the, you know, the full life cycle of where that application is running, and the upkeep of that is a bit different than I feel like it is with functions. So there was some good content around durable functions actually within the serverless open hack, which I know we talked about last time, kind of like waiting for like almost batch processing. So I want to wait until all of, you know, a certain number of files or certain number of things have occurred. You actually have that function running. So it's really cool. It's interesting, but I agree, sometimes understanding where it fits into the whole ecosystem is challenging.
Yes. I think that's why we all have jobs.
That's true.
There's so many options.
We were just talking about the different services that you can, or the different triggers for Azure Functions. And I know within Azure Functions, there's the idea of bindings. Can you explain to us what bindings mean and how do you connect Azure Functions with other services that we just mentioned? For instance, like Cosmos DB or EventGrid.
Yeah. So a function, kind of the couple key concepts around a function is like triggers and bindings, as you mentioned. And so there's a couple of different types of binding. So you have your input binding, and that kind of talks about the data that you might need for that particular function to pull in at the start of an execution. And you can have multiple input bindings. So like if you needed a trigger or a binding from Cosmos DB to then help execute that function, then that would be an example of an input binding. And then output binding would be same concept, but whatever you're trying to push out of that function. So whatever the output of that function execution is.
I think it's interesting too. I don't know if anybody else thinks this, and we may have mentioned this on the Dapper call, but there's some overlap, right, with the whole concept of input and output bindings and triggers. And so I think that's another really compelling, maybe future episode that we have. Allison, have you kind of been exposed yet to the Dapper open source project that Microsoft has created?
I haven't, no.
Yeah, so you should definitely look into it, but it is interesting because it can integrate with Azure Functions, it can integrate with a lot of Azure services, and it's still like not even to the V1 phase. I think we're on 0.7 now, 0.7 release, but just it's interesting because there is some overlap there, which once again, I think is another reason why we need to continue to have people coming on the podcast to kind of talk through, okay, if we have Dapper on the table now, like how does that work with functions? Where do we see some of those use cases? Because it is a bit similar from the input and output binding perspective. So,
yeah, Allison, just be careful. If you ever start talking to Kendall about Dapper, she'll be on the phone with you for hours. So
I've got a to-do, look into Dapper.
So what kind of languages, like programming languages, are you seeing people use in functions? Because I know one of the nice things of functions that supports like, you know, a lot of languages, right? What do people use?
So customers that I work with are heavy C# and Java users. So it's really great because like with functions, they have C# support, F#, Java, JavaScript. I think they've just announced Python. They're even introducing, I think, PowerShell's in preview at the moment. I think the level of investment, and this is one thing that's really exciting, I think, with Azure and serverless, is that they're, you know, the product group is like drastically increasing the amount of investment into this platform and into functions. So I know that they're constantly working with customers for feedback and getting insights into, you know, the developer experience as well, because that's one thing that really just is a level of investment from Microsoft overall, which is really exciting.
That's great. This is really good stuff, Allison. Thank you. Appreciate you kind of sharing all your expertise and passion in serverless. Any more questions for Allison before we let her go today?
I have one more. So I just when you talk about like an event-driven architecture using Azure Functions, are you seeing a lot of customers like front end that with API management or some type of API gateway? Because I feel like that's something that I've seen more and more customers really asking a lot about is API management and how do we front some of these APIs that we're building via functions. So I was just kind of curious what your thoughts were, if you have seen that at all.
It's definitely a conversation that happens. And I haven't worked with a customer that has implemented it yet. But that is a really good point. It's like, how do you, you know, say that you want to go serverless and you have all these APIs, you know, what makes the most sense? Is it incorporating API management and looking into those options? But to be continued.
I'm just curious because I know one pitfall I've seen is some customers doing that whole function chaining thing where you have a function that calls a function that calls a function where you fan out and managing to make sure that you're not that you're still following good development practices when you move to functions. Because some customers will say like, oh, well, how do I do this if I'm using functions? And it's like, well, how would you do that if it was just an app, right? Or if it was just a piece of code that you were running in an application, you know, a lot of that still applies. So just kind of was curious on that.
Well, Allison, thank you again for joining us. And if you have any favorite tips or resources that kind of led you on your journey to functions and serverless, let us know what it is and we'll put them along with the show notes with this podcast.
Yeah, absolutely. Okay? Thanks for having me.
All right. Thanks a lot for taking your time.
Thank you for listening to the show. If you have any thoughts, questions, or just want to connect, find us on Twitter at Azure Podcast. Background music has been taken from ccmixer.org under the Creative Commons license. We hope you'll tune in again soon to keep learning with us.